Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is episode 15 of our 20-part podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. In this episode, we're going to be covering the 14th century. That's from 1300 to 1400. And it seems that in every episode, I begin by saying, well, there's an awful lot that's happening in this century, an awful lot that is moving forward. But this is especially true now in this 14th century. In the 14th century, we are seeing the emergence of what we call the High Middle Ages. This is finally, for the last 300 or 400 years, we've been moving from a time of darkness into a time of reform in the church. And finally, these reforms are bearing fruit. And Europe is changing economically, socially, culturally, educationally, in many different ways. And in order to really understand what's going on in the 14th century, from 1300 to 1400, we have to again go back and look at some of the things which were taking place in the 12th and the 13th centuries. You might remember this was a period of reform in the church, where the church was moving out of the dark ages of the 9th and the 10th centuries, and moving into a time when the monasticism is spreading across Europe, and the monks are building up a kind of alternate infrastructure to the church itself. And then the monks who were establishing this infrastructure and this system across Europe eventually begin to take over the papacy and begin to take over the structures of power. And as they do in the 11th and 12th century, this reform movement starts to come into the church. And at the same time, nation states are beginning to grow up. Kings are beginning to gain individual power. Nations are beginning to emerge with a clearer identity, rather than the simply pockets of safety and civilization, which were dotted all over Europe, surrounding the monasteries and particular key cities and particular strongholds of local lords. And as this all develops, the church is impacted. I spent some time in the last episode, in episode 14, going back and rehearsing and reviewing the development of the different monastic orders. Remember, St. Benedict is in the 6th century, but then during this reform movement, there's the Cluniac reform of the monasteries based in the great monastery of Cluny in France. And it's then that the monasteries began to have this established infrastructure across Europe, where they belonged to the same order, and there was a sense of discipline and a sense of structure and hierarchy amongst the monastic orders. And then the Benedictines are reformed by the Cistercians, especially with St. Bernard of Clairvaux, where they return back to some of their original ideals and have an austere form of monasticism and architecture. And the Cistercian movement, again, sweeps across Europe and is hugely popular and hugely influential. And then we saw that in the last century, in the 13th century, between 12 and 1300, as the towns are beginning to grow, religious orders that emerge are not enclosed in monasteries in the countryside. Instead, the friars, the Dominicans and the Franciscans, come to the fore, and they are the religious who are living lives of apostolic poverty and apostolic preaching, spreading the gospel, not confined to a monastery, but out and about preaching and teaching and helping the poor and ministering to the needy. So these are called the mendicant orders, because mendicant means they were begging for their substance. And the mendicant orders, the Dominicans and Franciscans, begin to prosper. But also during this time, there's a further renewal in the monastic life. The Carthusians, the Camaldolese, the Carmelites are all founded during this time period, when there's a great resurgence of the faith. This is also sparked by economic changes that are taking place. There was an increase in technology for agriculture, and so there was increased wealth. And as the wealth began to increase, trade began to increase. And as trade began to increase, towns and cities began to grow. And as this growth is going on during the 12th and 13th centuries, something else is happening in addition to the renewal of religious life. The renewal of religious life amongst the people, as I was saying, in the monasteries and so forth, is also paralleled by a renewal of intellectual life. And so in this episode, I want to take a moment to go through the growth of the intellectual life of Europe so that we can see by the what we call the High Middle Ages, the zenith of the Middle Ages, which comes into the 14th and then the 15th centuries, that we have the towns and cities growing, we have an increase in wealth, and we have an increase in the religious orders that I've just gone through, but also the educational, the intellectual life of Europe is growing in an amazing way. And just to go back and review, what had happened during the 7th and 8th centuries, just after the breakdown of the Roman Empire, is the monasteries, the little monasteries that Benedict had started, became the centers of not just prayer and work, but also they became the centers of civilization. The social structures had broken down, and so when people were looking for a place to educate their sons, a place for healthcare, a place for charity and looking after the poor, they gravitated to the monasteries. And the monasteries began, therefore, to expand their work in the areas of charity and health and welfare, but also in education. So in the 7th and 8th centuries, when we go back that far, just in the wake of the breakdown of the Roman Empire, the monasteries were the centers of the educational system as well. Now, Charlemagne, who had this great ideal of bringing back the empire and civilization, began to start some schools in the cathedrals and began to promote education. But as the his dream of the empire began to crumble, then into the 9th and 10th centuries again, really the educational programs across Europe reverted back to the schools that were established by the monks. And so in the 9th and the 10th centuries, if you wanted an education for your son, you sent him to the monastery. And the monasteries therefore produced the educated classes in this time period. They were called clerks. And the clerks were the ones who were usually monks or priests, and they were the only ones who were educated. Therefore, they filled all the positions in the law courts. They filled all the positions where it was necessary for someone who was numerate and literate to be able to keep the wheels of society going. So you can see that the domination of the clergy in Europe in this time period was almost universal. They were the ones who controlled education, and therefore controlled all the positions which required an educated man. Well, as the towns began to grow, in the 11th and 12th century, some of the scholars who were educated by the monks began to take on students, and they formed guilds of scholars. And the guilds were like labor unions in the Middle Ages. There would be a guild of candle makers, and a guild of leather workers, and a guild of wheelwrights, and a guild of metal workers. And there was also a kind of guild of scholars and teachers and professors. They got together and formed a little working party. And as out of these informal confederations of scholars forming their own schools, which were now separate from the from the monasteries and from the cathedrals, the universities began to develop. And so the first universities were in Bologna in Italy and in Paris. And the popes of this time found these universities that were developing to be a special place where they could recruit workers for their administration, and the universities began to develop independence from the bishops and from the monasteries, and therefore they looked for protection subsidies to the Pope, and so the popes and the universities began to have a special relationship, if you like, in which it was a win-win. The popes would rely on the universities for their learning and for their students, and the universities relied on the popes for financial help and protection. And the universities, therefore, began to grow in their influence across Europe in the 12th century. So we see, therefore, that the various universities, which grew up first in Bologna and then especially in Paris, later on in Oxford and in Cambridge and elsewhere across Europe, began to thrive and provide a student population and professors right across Europe. So the dates for these, for instance, was the university was granted a charter by the Pope in 1200 at Salerno, in Oxford in 1200, in Cambridge a few years later, Naples, Padua, Pisa, Salamanca, Toulouse, Prague, Heidelberg, the Louvain, and of course in Paris. These major universities all were granted charters in the 1200s, in the 13th century. These universities studied basically three subjects: medicine, law, and theology. And if I can just take a moment now to do a little bit of philosophy with you, this is going to be very, very simple. I'm not a philosopher by any stretch of the imagination, but it is important to understand the mindset and the philosophy that was developing during these very crucial centuries towards the High Middle Ages. And to do that, we have to first of all go back and consider what the general mindset was about the nature of reality for most people. In the ancient world, of course, the understanding of reality was paganism, and that is that alongside the natural world that you could see, the physical world, was also a kind of infrastructure of gods and goddesses and spirits, which kind of infested, or were invisible, but kind of infested and dwelt within the natural world. So you have naiads, who were the spirits of trees, and dryads, who were the spirits of waters, and you had the different gods and goddesses who were the spirits of the different planets and the different natural order. There was a kind of, and paganism saw the natural world as being infused with all these various different personalities. Well, Greek philosophy under Plato begins to develop this idea of an alternative reality, but of course treats it in a philosophical way rather than a mythological way. And Plato's idea was that there is a world of what he called forms, or there's a world, an invisible world that runs parallel to this world. And that world is the one which is real, because everything in this world that you see, given enough time, will decay and fall back into nothing, because the physical world is temporary, bound by time and bound by the forces of decay and death. So Plato theorized that there was an alternative reality, which was the real world, which is, if you like, parallel to this world and separate to this world, but but connected, kind of in the old pagan idea. But this was not with gods and goddesses. Instead, this world of a form, or this world of abstract reality, was connected in through the natural world that we look at. Well, Aristotle comes along and he says, takes this one step further, and Aristotle's view is this invisible realm that exists is actually imbued into all the real things that you see. So this sofa that you look at is, Plato would say, well, there was a real sofa in this alternative reality, and this sofa that you look at, this physical sofa, is a kind of manifestation of that. But Aristotle says, no, that real sofa is kind of what makes this sofa that you're looking at substantial. We know that this particular sofa is going to rot and fall away, but every sofa that you see shares in that same reality in that particular sofa, not in some world elsewhere and some alternative reality. So this is the basic difference between Plato and Aristotle. So, and in the church up until the late Middle Ages, what existed was a kind of blend of Platonism and paganism. In other words, Neoplatonic philosophy basically perpetuated the idea that there is this alternative world. And they picked out Bible verses, for instance, from St. Paul where in 2 Corinthians, where he says, "We look to things which are seen, not to things which are unseen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are unseen are eternal." This was a kind of influence of Plato on St. Paul, where he's actually establishing the same kind of mindset that this world is falling into, will fall into nothing one day. This physical world that you see, everything will rot and decay and die. But there is an eternal world, which is on the other side, which is real, which is forever. And that this world is a kind of analogy or a pointer to that world. And this world is a little picture of that world, which lasts forever. And really, for the most part, up for the first 1,500 years of the church or so, this was the underlying understanding of the sacraments, underlying understanding of the world order. You see it with St. Augustine, with the city of God and the city of man, these two that the reality and of the invisible realm, and then there's this realm here, which is flawed and broken and subject to death and decay. Well, what we're going to see is that in this particular time period of the 13th century, all of this begins to change, and the reason it begins to change is because the complete works of Aristotle were discovered and they had been maintained in Jewish and Arabian circles of study. There were some particular Arab scholars, Averroes and Avicenna, both in the 11th and 12th century, who had developed the writings of Aristotle, translated the writings of Aristotle, and kept the writings of Aristotle in Europe. There were only one or two of Aristotle's writings which the philosophers and theologians had referred to. And therefore, theologians like Peter Lombard in the 12th century had relied pretty much on reading the scriptures and reading the fathers of the church to do their philosophy and to do their thinking. But when Aristotle's writings are rediscovered, suddenly everything begins to be transformed in a way which was actually very upsetting for people. Through the years 1150 to 1250, therefore in the century just before the one we're going to be looking at in this episode, all of the works of Aristotle were not only discovered, but they were translated. And therefore they made a huge impact just at the time that the universities were beginning to develop in Paris and Oxford and Cambridge and elsewhere across Europe. And the reason the discovery of Aristotle's work was so earth-shattering was because Aristotle presented a view of reality which was not reliant on supernatural forces of gods and goddesses and a supernatural force of the one God, for instance, interrupting all the time and doing miracles and changing things. Instead, Aristotle is proposing a systematized worldview, one which covered mathematics and science and philosophy and metaphysics, and he gave an account for everything within a rationally understood approach. In other words, just by human reason, he gave an explanation for what was there and didn't call on a supernatural intervention from other forces. Well, this was actually considered to be a great threat, and the church actually banned discussion on Aristotle's philosophy in the different universities. It didn't succeed because, of course, these ideas were so exciting and so earth-shaking for thinkers. But what happened instead was the Christian thinkers began to take Aristotle's thought and baptize it, began to take Aristotle's thought and apply it to Christian theology, which meant that Christian theology was going through a huge upheaval where Previously, they had simply relied on the church, pretty much on the church fathers, and a bit of Greek philosophy from Plato and what they knew of Aristotle, and on the sacred scriptures, and had this supernatural worldview in which God was totally and regularly involved doing miracles and involved in interfacing with this natural world. Suddenly, they're confronted with Aristotle and his totally rationalistic and totally human explanation for things. And there are three particular thinkers, therefore, in the 13th century, which are important. The reason I'm taking time to do all this is because we really have to see what was happening philosophically in the universities, in the schools of theology, so that we will be able to understand fully the revolution that was taking place intellectually, which therefore is going to set the stage for the great upheavals that we're going to see in the 15th and 16th centuries. So these three great thinkers who begin to baptize Aristotle, if you like, and come up with a new theology which integrates Aristotle's thought and Aristotle's method into Christian theology. These are, first of all, Saint Bonaventure, who dies in 1274, Albert the Great, who dies in 1280, and Thomas Aquinas, who also dies in 1274. So, in the 13th century, along with the development of the Franciscan and Dominican orders and the religious life, which was so active and so bountiful for the church, at the same time, in the same century, this intellectual life is going on. Very exciting discoveries going on in which these three thinkers, Bonaventure and Albert the Great, and his student, Thomas Aquinas, begin to integrate the thought of Aristotle into Christian theology. Now, we can't go into all the details here, but you can follow it if you like. It's just that this new theology was considered to be dangerous, and the philosophers understood that the old order, which was a kind of mix of Neoplatonism and paganism, this kind of supernatural understanding of reality in which God and the prayers of the saints and the supernatural mystery of the Mass and was constantly impinging and intermingling with and interacting with the natural world, suddenly. And this, of course, led to a fair bit of superstition in the church. And suddenly, rational explanations are being brought forward, and a rationalistic kind of theology is being brought forward. And this was a great revolution. We sometimes look at the theology of Thomas Aquinas as being a conservative thing in the church. In fact, when it came along, it was considered to be very liberal and very dangerous. So Bonaventure takes a rather mystical approach to this new thought which is coming in, and it's in as many ways still has one foot in the old mentality and begins to integrate Aristotle's work with that in mind. Albert the Great sees the scientific ramifications of Aristotle's thought. If the natural world can all be explained by human reason, and it's not just a great mystery of God's interactions with the natural world, but can be explained, then this is the foundation for modern science. And that's why Albert the Great is considered the patron of modern science, because in modern science we're bringing our human reason to bear on understanding the natural order and how things work. Thomas Aquinas is Albert the Great's student. I would recommend for a study of Thomas Aquinas, G.K. Chesterton's little biography called Thomas Aquinas. If you want a brief and an entertaining introduction to the great Thomas Aquinas, then go to G.K. Chesterton for that. And Thomas Aquinas writes this massive, voluminous work called the Summa Theologica, in which he covers just about every possible question from his point of view, in a very rational, a very clear, and a very logical sequence of explanations. And there are some wonderful books out there also which introduce the work of Thomas Aquinas. And you can, if you do a search online, you'll find them. Thomas Aquinas and Five Easy Steps and things like that, or Thomas Aquinas for Dummies. you can check into Thomas Aquinas without reading the entire Summa, and you can get a sampling of his thought and the way he subtly came to theology with this razor sharp mind, which analyzes and asks questions and works through the philosophy and the theology step by step, in a way which is simply awesome. And Thomas Aquinas is therefore considered one of the greatest philosophers that ever lived, but also one of the greatest geniuses who ever lived. One of the things about Thomas Aquinas which we should remember is that he was a Dominican friar, and also that he was a mystic. He was a man of prayer, and the great story about Aquinas is that at the end of his life, he had a mystical vision, and after that vision, he said, "Everything I have written, I consider to be just straw compared to what I have seen." And so what he has seen is therefore very exciting for the progress of theology into the future from that point. Thomas Aquinas is also embroiled in the controversies of philosophy and the philosophies of the theology of the time that's going to come after that. And I need to mention just a couple of other major figures during this time period, because they also help to set the stage for what's going to come. The Scotsman called Dun Scotus is also active just after the time of Thomas Aquinas. He's a Franciscan from Scotland. He studies in Oxford and in Paris and in Cologne in Germany. And Dun Scotus is a very attractive character. He's more mystical than Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas is very intellectual and very rational, but Dun Scotus has this almost a poetical approach to things in his philosophy. And whereas Aquinas is very much into classifying things and organizing things and a kind of separating things out to understand them, Dun Scotus has a much more unified vision of reality. He very much sees that the invisible world and the natural world are melded together in this kind of mystical unity and this mystical beauty. And it's within the contemplation of that that you're able to understand and see into the reality of things in a way which is intuitive and poetic. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins did a paper on Dun Scotus, was a scholar of Scotus, and he used this his philosophy to understand the method of poetry, for instance, and how a poet will see into the depth of something and then his expression of it will be poetic rather than rationalistic and logical. The last major figure that we need to talk about for just a moment within all of this focus on philosophy is an Englishman, William of Ockham. And William of Ockham is famous for a philosophical phrase called Ockham's Razor. And Ockham's Razor is basically the idea that you should go to find the simplest answer possible. By this time, academic philosophy and theology in Europe, with all these ideas swirling around, had become very highly intellectual, very highly specific, very highly specialized. You remember the old joke that the medieval theologians would argue about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. This is a typical sort of comment about the complexity and the of the arguments that were going on. And William of Ockham comes through and says, "Forget about it. Let's just go right to the basics." And he said all this talk about there being a real world that is invisible that you can't see, or maybe the real world is integrated into what you can see, and maybe there is another realm out there which interfaces with this realm. And William of Ockham said, "No, there's not. None of that is real. Let's just get down to basics and say that sofa that you see is that sofa that you see. It is not a link with some mystical sofa on the other side which you can't see, but which is the real one." Therefore, two different competing philosophies came about. One which is called realism, which says there is actually a real world, or a real aspect to things, which is invisible, and nominalism, which is rooted in the word for naming something and saying no, that invisible world, that real world you're talking about, that essence of things which is invisible but is lurking on the other side, which is eternal, it says no, that doesn't really exist, and what you see is what you get. Well, this philosophy of nominalism is a huge turning point in human thought and in Western philosophy. It's a huge turning point, which we will see is going to affect everything that comes after this in the 15th and in the 16th centuries. So we're going to come back to this later and talk about this foundation of nominalism, which was brought in by William of Ockham. And it's interesting that William of Ockham dies in 1350. So we're now into the 14th century, where we intended to get to start with, but I wanted to go through those events in the philosophy that was taking place in the 13th century, so that you could see where we're actually getting to when it comes to theology and the philosophy of the church in the 14th century. So by the 14th century, The philosophy and the work of Thomas Aquinas had now been around for he had been dead for almost 25 years by the dawn of the 14th century, and this revolution in theology, which therefore brought a revolution in the way theologians and clergy and academics and scholars began to look at the world. This revolution was now 25 years underway, and we're going to see how it actually affects everything as we move forward. But what we have to do now is look for a few moments at the rest of the details in the 14th century. And to do that, we're going to just remind you that in the 13th century, the great pope was Innocent III. He's followed by a quick succession of other popes who were not bad popes, but they were still reforming popes. The major one being Gregory X at the toward the end of the 13th century. And as we turn from the 13th into the 14th century, there's a very important transition. This is, you might remember, Gregory X is the pope who said that for the popes to be elected, the cardinals had to be in a locked room, and they were locked in until they elected a pope, and their rations were reduced day by day until they did, because the conclaves were taking so long because of political fighting and factions. And so the cardinals are locked in to elect a successor to the pope, and as usual, the Italian families are warring back and forth, but now the French king also has his oar in, and he's trying to control the conclave and get his pope elected, and the quarrels are going back and forth and back and forth. And finally, the cardinals say, why don't we elect this monk, a hermit, a holy man who's in his 80s, and so they go and find him in his cave, and he takes the name of Celestine the Fifth, and Celestine the Fifth goes to become pope, and he decides not to live in Rome. He gets some of his Franciscan-like followers, and they fall in with the king of Sicily in the southern part of Italy, who promises to support them. And it's very obvious that the burden of the papacy is too much for this old man. And so Celestine the Fifth, after just a few months in office, is persuaded to resign. And this is the first pope who resigns under these conditions. He's encouraged to resign by Cardinal Benedetto Gaetani, who soon after Celestine resigns, is himself elected as Pope Boniface VIII. This is in 1294, And so he's the Pope which takes us through into the beginning of the 14th century. And Boniface the Eighth is one of the most famous and notorious of the popes. He is the Pope who, for instance, establishes the Jubilee in the year 1300, when thousands and thousands of pilgrims came to Rome in order to gain the indulgence for going on the Jubilee. And Boniface VIII is mentioned in Dante's Inferno. Dante puts him well down in hell because of his wickedness. And nevertheless, he did some good things and brought in some reforms. But Boniface VIII was also very intent on establishing his secular power as well as the papal power. It's also true that he was an unattractive character, inasmuch as he said, for instance, that sleeping with, having sex with boys or women was no worse than just rubbing your hands together. He was also accused of being an unbeliever, that he didn't believe in heaven or hell or in the resurrection. And he was really very much concerned to try to interfere with the politics of his day. And so he was unsuccessful at it. So he interfered, for instance, with the monarchs in Poland and Hungary, and worst of all, he fell afoul of the King of France. And we have to understand what this argument was about a little bit. What happened was the popes had used the power of taxing the clergy to raise money for the Crusades. And the King of France decided that he was going to do this instead, to raise money from the clergy to fund his own sort of particular battles and his adventures in warfare. Well, the Pope didn't take to this very kindly, because obviously that was a source of income for the Pope, and why should the French king take it? So the Pope issues a couple of bulls and excommunicates the King of France. There's one particular bull that he issued called Unum Sanctum, which is very famous because Pope Boniface VIII says, "It is altogether necessary for salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman Pontiff." Well, that's a pretty high claim, and the problem was he didn't really have the muscle to back it. And he had made the mistake, for instance, very early on, of waging a battle against his family's traditional rivals, the Colonna family. He actually went to their home city, and he leveled the city, and there was a massacre that went on against the inhabitants, the Colonna inhabitants. He had deposed the cardinals from the conclave, from the College of Cardinals, who were from the Colonna family. So this feud was going on in the background, and so the King of France decided that he was going to head down there and take care of things. So he, with members of the Colonna family, allied to the members of the Colonna family, actually attacks Boniface at his palace. And surrounded by his enemies, Boniface comes out and very haughtily says, "Here's my neck, here's my head," challenging them to kill him. Well, they backed away from that and were soon expelled from the town by some of Boniface's supporters. But this attack on the Pope as a person was devastating to him, and he died a month later. The whole thing was very shocking to people, that the Pope would actually be attacked in his person like that by the King of France. Nevertheless, the French by now had control of the College of Cardinals, and Boniface's successor, Benedict the Ninth, was elected, but he only lasted about 9 months, and the conclave again sat in deadlock for 11 months until finally Pope Clement the Fifth was elected, and he was under the influence of the French cardinals and also under the French king. Furthermore, the situation in Rome was more and more unfriendly to him, because he wasn't a Roman, and so he decided at that point to settle in Avignon. So in 1309 we begin the Avignon, what's called the Avignon Papacy, and Clement the Fifth, who was Pope from 1305 to 1314, settled in Avignon, and six of his successors during this century, during the 14th century, had the papacy settled not in Rome, but in Avignon in France. And furthermore, as that happened, the church was continually and increasingly dominated by the French and by the French king, the French court, and the French cardinals. So what we have now during the 14th century is a French papacy settled in France instead of in Rome and Italy, and more of the power is focusing there in Avignon, where the popes are. Furthermore, I said that this the philosophy that had happened the century before was going to influence what is taking place in the church. And sure enough, with the rise of the philosophy of Aristotle, people began to question, therefore, the relationship between church and state. You remember the relationship under the thought of Augustine was that there's the city of God and the city of man, and it's almost like the invisible, real city of God had connections with the political kingdom of the city of man, and the king was meant to be a Christian king, and the relationship, as you remember, was between the Pope and the king, and the popes would crown the emperor, and the emperors would appoint the bishops, and the emperors would try to appoint and elect the Pope, and there was this idea that the state was an arm of the church, and the church was a part of the state, and there was this integrated system between church and state, between the city of God and city of man. But when Aristotle's thought comes through and says, no, these distinctions between the supernatural and the natural, these distinctions between the real and the physical world, and all of these, the distinction between the invisible world and the visible world, all these distinctions don't matter. And they're not to be intermingled in this same way. Instead, the state is the state, and the church is the church. And we begin seeing the seeds of the separation of church and state, which we now take for granted in the modern world, coming about. And so this is also happening in the papacy, in which the secular rulers and the spiritual rulers are beginning to drift apart. So this continues, the Avignon papacy continues for the next six popes. Clement the Sixth, for instance, was in Avignon. He was a good pope. He stayed there during the Black Death, which was the plague which swept through, killing tens of thousands of people. But he was a profligate man, spending money like water and depleting the papal revenues and setting a bad example. The separation of the papacy from Rome was a scandal, and you might remember that Saint Catherine of Siena was alive during this particular century. And Catherine of Siena was a Dominican third order who was a mystic and a great reformer in the church. She would write letters to the Pope. She actually called the Pope my sweetest daddy, and she used to tell him what to do. So, and the pope that she used to write to was Pope Gregory the 11th, who was pope from 1370 to 1378. And she encouraged Pope Gregory, who was a very spiritual man and a Frenchman, to actually go back to Rome. She said to him, "You should attend things to spiritual, appointing good shepherds and good rulers in the cities under your jurisdiction. Above all," she said, "delay no longer in returning to Rome and proclaim the next crusade." And so Pope Gregory the 11th in 1378 listens to St. Catherine of Siena and returns to Rome, at which point the papacy's time in Avignon seemed to be ended. Well, true to form, when he dies in 1378, there's again all sort of political pressures going on, when the cardinals come into conclave, and the pressures between now the Italians and the French, and the Italians are dead set against electing another French cardinal as pope, and they elect the Archbishop of Bari, an Italian, Bartolomeo Prignano, and he takes the name of Pope Urban VI. Now, the problem is, 6 months after he's elected pope, he turns out to be overbearing, violent, and probably insane. And the cardinals who elected him, therefore, get together and they depose him. They repudiate him, and they declare the election to be invalid because they say they were under political duress. And they elect the Cardinal Bishop of Geneva as Pope Clement VII instead. And now they've got two popes. The Great Schism had begun, and Clement, who had just been elected pope, he goes back to Avignon, and he creates his own curia, his own infrastructure. Meanwhile, Urban remains in Rome, and he creates a new curia, because the cardinals had just elected Clement. They went back with him to Avignon, and Urban is in Rome and creates a new curia. Now, you can see what's going to happen before too long. As this schism goes on, each pope is creating bishops, each pope is appointing abbots, and sometimes when there was a vacancy, there would be therefore two bishops in a diocese, one appointed by Clement, one appointed by Urban. When there was a parish priest to be appointed, there would be two appointed by each of those two bishops. And so as it went down through the hierarchy, right through the church, the schism spread into every aspect and every detail of church life. And so there were rival popes and rival colleges of cardinals, all appointing competing bishops and abbots for the same sees and monasteries. The expenses of both became great, because now you're running two infrastructures and two papacies. First, most of all, the church was scandalized, because how could the church be unified and have two different popes? The pope was meant to be the head of the church, the successor of Peter. You can't have two popes. Well, taking the long view, the church has decided that actually Pope Urban and his successors were the proper and valid popes. But they couldn't see that at the time. And so all during the second half of the 14th century, we have the Great Schism, from the election of Urban VI in 1378 right through to the end of the century, this terrible scandal of the Great Schism continuing. And it was out of this scandal that the authority of the popes was actually lessened, and the authority of councils began to grow, because the church leaders, the cardinals and the faithful, got together and said, how are we going to solve this problem? Urban won't step down, Clement won't step down, their successors won't step down, we've got two popes, this can't go on, how can we stop it? Because who has authority over a pope? Who has the authority to do this? And so they got together and saw that a council would be the solution. And so in 1409, just now at the beginning of the 15th century, a group of disillusioned cardinals from both sides got together, they gathered at Pisa in Italy, and they deposed Pope Gregory the 12th, who was the successor of Urban in Rome, and Pope Benedict the 13th, who was the successor in Avignon in France. And they elected a new pope, Alexander the 5th. The problem is, there were now three popes, and we're going to pick up the story there, because we're now at the beginning of the 15th century, and that will be episode 16, and I hope you'll tune in to listen to how this is going to be resolved next time. Thank you for listening. This has been Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. Remember, you can always go over to my blog, and you can read my daily blog post there and continue to learn more about the church and current events right now. But at the end of each of these sessions, I like to just reflect a little bit on how it touches on where we are in the church today. First of all, we have the connection with Pope Celestine the Fifth, who is the only other pope to have resigned, and we are now living in a historic time when we have two popes, similar to the Great Schism. Now, fortunately, Francis and Benedict seem to be brothers in arms, and there's not a schism and a power struggle, but it's very interesting that Benedict the 16th, when he was pope, paid two special private pilgrimages to the grave of Pope Celestine V, and paid homage to Celestine V, obviously thinking all the time that he might pick up on this precedent and he might also resign. And so we're in another historic time period right now. And despite the fact that Francis and Benedict are brothers in arms, and all of the public relations people make that to be the case, there certainly seems to be a kind of informal schism in the church, in which some people who loved Benedict and loved his traditional approach to liturgy and his traditional approach to theology don't like Francis and see him as a liberal and see him as a someone who's opposed to what Benedict was trying to do and who's changing things radically and taking the church in the wrong direction. While this is not a formal schism, there does seem to be this division in the church today, which echoes and harkens back to the great schism in the 14th century. This is one of the reasons I'm doing this series on the history of the church, so that we can see that the struggles that we face right now are nothing new. The other thing about the 13th and 14th century was the revolution in theology and the revolution in thought that took place. When Aristotle's philosophy and writings were discovered, there was a huge shift in understanding of the church, understanding of humanity, understanding of God's work in the world, and the church had to cope with this. The church had to cope with a new way of looking at things and integrate this in a way which was risky and dangerous. We're living in a similar period of change in the world. We have a new technology, new technologies which every day are taking us into unknown areas and unknown realms. We have new ways of looking in the world, new ways of looking at society, with globalism, with increased travel, with cheaper travel, with integration of different nationalities and ethnicities, with the global village. All of these things are changing, and changing very rapidly in the world in which we live. It was the same in the 13th and 14th centuries. New ways of being, new economies were rising up. The old medieval order surrounded around the monasteries was beginning to crumble, and humanity, Europe, the church, is beginning to shake itself and move into a whole new period. During this time period, it's no mistake or no coincidence that the papacy itself is going through transition and change. The papacy is no longer in Rome. It's in Avignon. Now there's two popes. Now there's three popes. And so this is a time of huge transition and tumultuous change for the people in the church and people in the world. What is it that saw us through these huge changes? When the philosophy of Aristotle was discovered, many people were opposed to it because they said it does away with the need for God. This is all explained naturally and rationally. There's no need for God, no need for the supernatural. And yet, it was out of that that Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus and various others came up with new arguments for the existence of God, which came out of the Aristotelian revolution in thought. So this is the way that God always works in the world. It is through the crisis that the church faces that the Holy Spirit brings new seeds of renewal and new seeds of understanding and new ways of being. Remember, you can never go back. History, does not have a reverse gear. It only moves forward, but it can move forward positively, building on what we know from the past. And that seems to be the lessons that we learn from history in the church, that when new challenges come along, it's the resources from the past which help us to conclude and move forward. Thank you for listening.